So, I was driving home from London earlier this year and discovered that I could WhatsApp through my car phone without breaking the law. Consequently, my poor PR guru, Sarah Lewis, who's tolerated my unsociable timings for over 20 years, got bombarded with ideas for series 5 of my podcast. I wanted successful, interesting entrepreneurs who I thought that I couldn't get. I got to Flitwick, which was about 15 minutes on the M1, and that was it. Lime and basil, pomegranate noir. I was going to get Jo Malone. After all, I'd lived with her in my home for many years, in every room, and with my undisputed determination, by the time I got off at Junction 19, and thanks to the font of all knowledge, Ruth Langsford, I had a nail. It's never what you know, it's who you know, and having the chutzpah to dare. So it's with huge, great anticipation that I welcome the wonderful Jo Malone to Events That Made Me.
What a lovely introduction. Thank you very much. And thank you, lovely Ruthie.
I sometimes wonder whether, I know you started off fairly humble beginnings. You left school at 13 and you looked after your mother. So education must have been a challenge. And then all of a sudden, you know, wham, bang, you are literally a worldwide name. I've got loads of questions I want to ask you, but I have to go through the list that you sent me because all my guests send me 4 events that made them turn right or left. And your first one was marrying Gary. Tell me why that was so significant to you.
I think, so I came from very humble beginnings, as people would have either read in the book or heard me talk about. But I was really family. I was about 14, 15 when I completely left school. So I got no qualifications. And I had this real kind of desire to help other young people. And so I went off to do a counseling course at a local Bible college. And there I met this very tall, blonde, incredibly preppy, good-looking young man called Gary, who at that point wanted to become a vicar. And let me tell you, if he had become a vicar, he would have had a full church every Sunday, that's for sure. And I fell hopelessly in love with him. And we were young kids, you know, we're in our 20s. It was that first love. But that first love, I looked at him and I just thought, I want to marry you. I want to be your wife. But I didn't want to be a vicar's wife in any way, shape or form. I knew that. And so our kind of wonderful relationship continued. And we got married, walked up the aisle together. And there I said to him, you know, I'd love to run a first business and do all these things. And he very kindly agreed. He agreed to marry me and he agreed to help set up our first business. But marrying him, it brought me huge love, security, happiness. Gary and I are both very, very different. So I'm very right brain and Gary's very left brain. So everything that we both were not, we were able to bring who we were into the relationship and make the relationship much bigger.
And did he start the business with you, Jo?
Yes, yeah, he did. At the time when we were first married, I was running a small little skincare clinic, which is where it all began. And Gary was a building surveyor. So he was really and is very good with money. So he, at one point, was counting bricks in bags of cement. And then a few months later, when we were working together, it was perfume bottles and scented candles, but it didn't really matter. You know, it was cost versus profit versus, you know, everything that a business is about. But in the very beginning, when we first started out, it was our first shop. Gary and I started from day one together. Yeah.
And from a very personal perspective, what has intrigued me is how did you were young and probably fairly unsophisticated at the time.
It's still a
No, you're not. You're not. And you delved into the world of scent. And I thought to myself, where did you get, or where does one get the inspiration for scent? I mean, I'm interested to understand. How did you do it?
I think my sense of smell, because of my dyslexia, I'm severely dyslexic. And often, you know, your senses become sort of slightly muddled. For me, the power of storytelling is my language is scent notes. So when I smell something, I'm telling you a story of my life. And whether that was the beginning, the middle, or where I am right now. Every fragrance I create, I'm telling you the story, but I'm using notes instead of words or music or flavor or any of those things. And from a very, very young age, I had this incredible sense of smell. And I thought everybody could smell the way I could. I could smell when the dog was sick. I could smell when it was going to rain. I could smell when my father's canvases that I had whitewashed were dry and ready to go and for him to paint and create art on. So that power of smell for me was a really important sense. But when you have it naturally and you've had it all your life, you think everybody else can. And it wasn't until I got much older that I discovered that I could think about fragrance and I could smell it in my head. And then I was able to translate what was in my head and for it to become a real product. But it was more than that. I started to look at color and I could smell fragrance too. So it's something called synesthesia. Now I know what it is. But in those few sort of years in the beginning, it was this raw ability, natural ability to create fragrance. And I could take red and pink and green and everyone else would see color, but I would actually smell fragrance. So it was, and apparently my brain is just wired in a different way. So very, very lucky. With the dyslexia, my brain kind of looks at information in a different fashion.
Which was your first scent?
I created the typical rose petals in the garden that you do as children. And I remember my first face cream, which involved rosemary and camphor, rose oils. So I was, from the age of 7, 8, I was always in a laboratory and I always understood how cosmetics were created and how important fragrances were. It was probably, you know, something, I did a frais de bois, a wild strawberry, I did a violet, all kinds of different concoctions.
You must have been everybody's best friend, but everybody wanted samples. So in 1990, you sell the business and it's 9 years later to a global brand. Yep. What made you sell it? Forget the financials, because I'm not interested in asking you figures. But did you not feel it was like giving your baby away?
No, because I think a lot of businesses at some point, when you grow from a kitchen top and you have this unbelievable success, which we did with the first brand, and it rolls and rolls. As you grow, you have this little pool of money that you call profit, and profit becomes pennies very quickly once you're protecting yourself in other territories. And we were then global. We were taking the brand globally. You need to IP it, protect your intellectual property. You need to trademark. You need teams in each territory to make sure that you can roll the brand. Then you need PR. You need all the things that go with it. And so that little pocket of profit gets smaller and smaller and smaller until the point of which your growth starts to backfire. So you start to slow down in growth and you start to feel, okay, where do we go from here? And listen, it's happening today, right now, right this very minute, with thousands of businesses across the world. They will absolutely identify with what I'm saying. And so what do you do? Do you sell part of the equity of your company? Do you borrow money? Do you take a venture capitalist? Or do you collaborate with somebody and they help you build? And so we were at that point of which we were growing so rapidly and everyone could see us. And at that point, Liz, we were kind of the only one on the street doing it. There wasn't lots of people as there are today, creating these wonderful little niche jewels of brands. And so when Lauder walked through the door, it was Leonard walked through the door and his team. And he asked me, would I fly to New York, go and have breakfast with him and go and talk about our brand? And of course, it's just like the kings just walked through your door. And I did. I remember flying, and it was such a weird day. I remember flying from Heathrow, and Gary and I were in the back of the bus, and it was a Sunday, and we'd heard that there was a snowstorm in New York City, and we still decided to go. And as we sat down, I opened You magazine, and I read the story of Bobby Brown, who had sold her business to Lauder. And as I sat in that seat and I read it, my life went to me, this is going to happen to you. This will happen to you. We arrived in New York City. There was a blizzard. It was a blizzard of, I don't know, what, I can't remember, 89 or whatever it was. I can't remember. and the whole of the city came to a standstill. We arrived at our hotel and I said to Gary, the meeting will be cancelled. And it wasn't. And the next morning we sat before the whole Lauder team from, at that point, Prescriptives, Clinique, all of them were all together. And I had breakfast with Leonard Lauder. And so the process began of the appetite for an acquisition. And from day one, I just knew in my heart of hearts. I remember them saying to me in the boardroom, and I was being questioned left, right and centre. It was funny. I wasn't at all intimidated. I was enjoying every single second of it. And I remember them saying, what are you looking for? And of course, they wanted me to say the figure I was looking for. And of course, there was no way, by the way, no way you ever do that. If someone asks you the figure, never tell them. You say, no, you tell me what you think I'm worth, first of all. And I was looking for a partner that could help with distribution. We were looking for deep pockets, but I was looking for somebody that had heart and love of an industry. I actually found that heart definitely with Leonard Lauder.
I've got goose pimples here and I've got like a knot in my stomach because it's just the most gorgeous, gorgeous story. But then it didn't stop you, did it? You sold it and then you started again.
Well, I think the important bit is, and this is why these are the moments that made me, I sold the business and I thought I was going to stay with it forever and a day, as you often do, you know, something. And I mean, Gary and I, when we first started, we didn't have a penny to rub together. And we used to sleep on a piece of blue foam, which we bought from Homebase. And of course, the first time that we sold our business, the delight of sleeping in a double bed for the first time, probably of our marriage, actually, in those first years, feeling that we were the luckiest two kids on the face of this earth. And then our life really did start to change. I was traveling. I worked with an amazing guy called Joe Gubernick. And Joe was the first man in Lauder that worked with Evelyn Lauder on Clinique. And he had worked with Estee Lauder as well. And when I went into the laboratories with Joe for the first time, he said to me, okay, where's your formulations that we can follow? And I said, they're in my head, Joe. He said, what do you mean they're in your head? I said, I don't know how many grams. I pour it until it smells right. And he just put his hands over his head and he said, oh my goodness, it's Mrs. Lauder all over again. And he and I had the most incredible relationship, I can't tell you. But I was traveling, I was doing things. I'd had my son, Josh. I was 38 years old. And that's when my curveball hit. And the reason I left is because I was diagnosed with breast cancer and I had to spend a year fighting cancer. And that was a left and a right, I suppose, moment for me.
That was the second event, actually, that you gave me. And it's one that we all dread, yeah. You know, how did you cope with it, Jo?
I survived. I think coping with a life-threatening situation. So I remember that night of being diagnosed and they gave me 9 months. They said to me, you need to get your life in order. And of course, I was looking at my little baby son who was three, my poor husband who was broken by the whole thing. And they said, we can see by the scan that you have a very aggressive form of breast cancer. And what happens, they look at your scans and then the next 7 days you have to go through all the tests. That is the worst bit. And at the end of those tests, they said to me, you have breast cancer, it is very aggressive, and you've probably got about 9 months to live. And it's at that point I thought, whoa, I couldn't believe, you know, I was 38 years old, and I thought it was a cyst, and they were just going to drain it. And I remember going home and thinking, I was sobbing, and I was thinking, my son, I'll never see him grow up, I'll never see him go to school, I'll never see him go to university. And I looked at, you know, what was poor Gary going to do? And then I thought, hold on a minute, Joe. You have never listened to anybody in your life and listened to what they think your life should be. Don't listen to them. And this kind of like Joe head came into my being. I called the most amazing late Evelyn Lauder, and she was climbing a mountain. And I remember her PA saying, hold on, Joe, I'm just connecting you. And I could hear the wind whistling in the background. And she came on and I said, Evelyn, she was one of the most incredible women in the world. And I said, Evelyn, I have breast cancer and I'm going to die. And I remember her saying, remember, honey, you make lemonade from lemons. And within 24 hours, I was on a plane to New York City and I went to see an amazing doctor called Dr. Larry Norton at the Sloan Kettering, which is one of the best cancer hospitals in the world. And I started a process which took nearly 18 months. I was one of the first women to take chemo every 5 days for a year. I had a mastectomy. I had operation after operation after operation and was in intensive care more times than I can even choose to remember. And then one day, my gorgeous Larry Norton walked into my hospital room. And there I was. My hair was just coming back. I'd finished all my chemo. And he said, it's gone. It's gone today. And you need to go and start living your life again. And Liz, I never thought I'd make it. I never thought I'd get there. And then you start the tightrope scenario where you've gone through all your treatment of cancer and then you have to wait to see if it comes back. That is a horrible bit. But during that time, I came back to London. What I hadn't told anybody was I had lost my sense of smell. So at that point, I was still with Lauder. And I knew that I could not stay in a brand, a global brand, and be there if I couldn't smell. And so I resigned. I resigned. I gave in my notice. Everyone tried to stop me. And I said, no, I'm going. And in my mind's eye, I was never, ever going to create another bottle of fragrance again. I'd done that. I ticked that box and I'd moved on. Walked home. And I asked Leonard to be the last person to turn the key in the lock of the shop in Sloane Street. And he said, yes. So I put the bottles on the shelf. And inside of me was, what have you done? You've made the biggest mistake of your life. And it was, you know, those moments in life where things go too far to pull it back. And I felt that. So I walked home, sobbed. And about 4 weeks later, I woke up and I could smell everything. My sense of smell had come back overnight. And I could smell everything. I was like an animal. I could smell wet earth. I could smell a piece of paper. I could smell everything. I could touch like an orange skin and it would just burst with fragrance for me. And so I started those 5 years, which of course was a lockout and a non-compete, with my sense of smell, all my dreams and aspirations, and nowhere to put them. And it was at that point that I probably had my lowest moment in my life.
Did you regret your decision?
No, I didn't. And I still don't today. If I sold my business again, I would do it very differently. But everyone will say that. I didn't regret it. And if I hadn't done all those things, I'd never be sitting here talking to you right now. I'd never be sitting in Elizabeth Street. And, you know, sometimes it's a lesson in life is sometimes we make the wrong call at the wrong time. It's not the end of the world. You can find your way back. You can find your way to new adventures because we're human beings. We don't always make the right decisions at the right time. I would be a very different person now if I'd stayed. And I like who I am now.
What year, Jo, did you form Jo Loves?
So she was formed, it was after the 5-year lockout.
Is she a she?
And it was 2011. We were sitting at home. Yeah. Oh, yeah, she's definitely a she. Do you know, I learned in those 5 years, I learned more about who Jo was. And I realized that creating fragrance wasn't a business or a company. It was my best friend. And I missed my best friend more than anything. I love creating. I come alive when I create.
Are you a very good cook?
I'm a good cook. I'm not a very good cook.
You look like you're a very...
I am a good cook, though.
You
love
do look like
flavor.
You're a very good cook.
Oh, I love food. I love food and wine and laughter. Yeah, so anyway, so we were sitting having dinner. We were sitting having a spaghetti, and it was Josh was 7. And I sat there and I said to Gary, I really want to start again. I really want to see. Because I knew I was too old to sit there and start something completely different. That's what I felt. And I was too young to sit and regret. So I either had to get back on the stage and see whether I could build another global brand. And it was always about building a global brand. It was never about creating a bottle of fragrance. I'd had that appetite and that taste of building something global, and I loved it. And I said, I want to start again, but I have no idea where I start. And Gary said, well, what do you want to call yourself? Because you can't be Jo Malone. I said, but I am Jo Malone. And he said, I know, but you can't be Jo Malone in a business. And it suddenly all dawned on me what it was I'd really sold. It wasn't just I hadn't just sold lime, basil and mandarin and pomegranate noir. I had sold my name, the rights to go out there and trade in business. But I was still the person. And I've never used my married name. So I've always been Jo Malone. So where on earth was I? And then Josh suddenly puts his hand up in the middle of eating spaghetti. And he said, Mum, I know what you should call yourself. And I said, yes, darling. He said, just call yourself Jo Loves, because fragrance loves you and you love fragrance. And it's as he said it, it was so out of the mouths of angels and it was so simple. And I checked legally, was I allowed to use it? And yes, I absolutely was. And so that night, Little Jo Loves was born. I formulated four fragrances, of which the first was Pomelo. She was a big turning point. Pomelo was the first fragrance after 5 years. And then we started on this huge, incredible journey of building again and building globally.
Is Josh in the business with you?
No, he's made it clear he doesn't want to sell. He's gone to university.
Good for
and
him.
And he is much more of a humanitarian.
Is he?
Than a retailer. And he doesn't want to sell candles.
And Joe, what is your favourite scent? Don't tell me you've not got a favourite. Because I think, let me just tell you what I think. Your scents are very, very distinctive. So when you feel a bit sexy and you've got a bit nice underwear on and the candles are lit, it's pomegranate noir for me. And when I wake up in the morning and the sun's shining, I'm in the shower with lime and basil. And so they're all very, they're very much how you feel. So those were my scents of the Jo Malone. Yeah. So the Jo Love ones, and obviously they're all very distinctive. Ruth Langsford always sends me Jo Loves. I've got a whole thing, bath and everything in here. So which are your favourites?
So the notes I love citrus. I love sort of florals, but I changed in the last year. I've really changed the things I love. I love Pomelo because she always, it was the story of starting again and it was the very first one. Jo by Jo Loves is a mezze of grapefruit. That's the one that I did for myself. So when you talk about feeling sexy and that is, it's a power fragrance. But at the moment, we've just launched one called Ebony and Cassis. And I think it's because I'm living in a different part of the world now. And it's a really rich, smoky, charcoal kind of cedarwood. It's really masculine. I'm loving that. But I don't have one fragrance that I think that's my favorite of all of them, because it would be like me wearing my favorite dress every single day for the rest of my life. I think fragrance is all about art and color for your nose. So, but I love a bit of citrus. I love vetiver. I love actually Guerlain's vetiver. My dad used to wear that. So there's certain smells. I loved Chanel 19. I love Barney's Rudité. I love Margriffe by Carven. So all of these sort of like mezze of fragrances, I kind of in love with the sense of smell.
But you're lucky. You can just get up in the morning and take one off the shelf and think, I feel like this one today. I'm going to wear this one. And it's just, and it's all part of, it's very much part of getting dressed. I have, you know, a routine and I get up and I shower and I put my makeup on. I go to the office and I wear different perfumes and it's very much how you feel. And I think it says so much about you. It's a necessary accessory for all women. What are you spraying there?
So this, it hasn't got a name yet, but this is one of my favourite. I've just done this one. Oh, it is. It's a beautiful kind of like orange. But there's only 10 bottles in the world of that. And because I'm creating with it, it's like it's got all my attention at the moment. So that's what I love. I love a little bottle. So if you ever see me, you can't smell it. If only you could. So the whole place is smelling of like the citrus of an orange, but it's got this wonderful, very, very strong, powerful wood, which is making it really, really masculine, but very couture, very Paris, very South of France. It's divine. When you say what is your favourite thing, it's often the thing I'm working on because it's what my mind is thinking about the whole time and the complexities of fragrance and how you can push all different notes.
How many bottles are there? 10? Can you not make it 11 and send me one? Don't be mean. Anything that's Paris and South of France and very chic and sexy, you know, we all think we're somebody that we're not. But anyway, listen, I can live in hope. And then in 2008, you got the MBE, didn't you, before you embarked on Joe Loves. And then in 2011, you got the CBE. I mean, how many letters can a woman have after a name, Joe?
Oh, my CBE is so... I mean, I look at them both and I think I was the girl from the council estate that has no education, that was told she would never make anything of her life. And there I was with who is now King Charles giving me my MBE and my CBE. And I can't tell you both of those days to be honoured by your country. And I look at those beautiful medals, which you could only wear now and again. They're in my knicker drawer, in fact. They're all sort of in the back of my knicker drawer. And every now and again, I bring them out and I go and have a look. And I just think, wow, you know, to be honoured by your country, it's very, very special. And I'm very proud.
What one piece of advice, before we get on to your fourth event, what one piece of advice would you give? And remember, we're living in very different times. Everything's far more competitive. Money's tight. What one piece of advice would you give?
Well, you know what? History repeats itself, doesn't it? And we've had really tough times before, and competition. Competition breeds the market. Competition is good. It keeps you on your toes. And no one is responsible for making your dreams happen but you. And if you want something to occur in your life, you have to go and grab it with two hands. You have a bank account full of creativity. No one can access it but you. And I truly believe this. And the only way that creativity, like a currency, will go up in value is if you use it. So creativity is something that when we look back in life, when we look at all those times that were really hard in business and hard in the world, that's where that creative platform is so important in our lives and affecting kind of a generation. Do you know, last night I was sitting having dinner. I flew in and my son's friends were sitting having dinner, and the conversation had at that table last night about AI technology blew my mind. And I sat there and I listened to this young man, Andrew, who is one of the cleverest people, talking about technology and the future. And I was thinking to myself, my goodness, his bank account of creativity is, he's a billionaire with creativity. He is invested. He's just going off to work for Google. And it's that ability to take what you have and make it bigger and bigger and then share it. And share that excitement. And that, because when one person becomes creative, I then think creatively. Then I think creatively, then somebody else. Everybody kind of profits. So, yeah, use your bank account of creativity and invest in it.
Mine's always been, you can never fail. You can only learn, and you trust your gut. And I think when you say that, you've got to acknowledge your creativity. You've got to acknowledge your strengths and go with them. But I think that's a wonderful, wonderful piece of advice. Your last event I resonated with a little bit, because mine's not as exciting, but I've always been terrified of water. And I was in Barbados recently, and I thought, I was staying with a friend, and I got there 2 days before she did, and she has a home there. And I thought, sod this, I'm going to learn to swim because I'm terrified of it. So I Googled swimming instructors in Barbados, and I stuck a pin in a donkey, and this girl rocks up the next morning with all these things, you know, floats. And I thought, oh my God, what have I done? But I did it, and it was the hardest thing. But by the end of the week, I was swimming with my goggles, with my face in the water, out of my depth, you know, at 67, thinking, right, that's one thing on my bucket list. If I get thrown off the back of the millionaire's yacht that I've not met yet, at least I'll be able to swim to shore. Yours, however, is far more dramatic. Yours is far more...
Not at all.
Yes, it is.
Not at all. I can't swim either, Liz. I can't swim. That, I think that is so amazing, and well done you. That's so incredible. And I'm definitely, in the next year, I'm going to learn to swim. But my turning point was, I believe life happens in trilogies, and I'm definitely in my third trilogy. And I've always felt like I was meant for something really big in the world. And adventurers always found me, or I've gone out to, you know, I've met somebody and something has always happened. But this time, it's almost as though life is saying, you've got to go find it now, Joe. You know, it's come to you many times, but you have to go find this last one. And I had been suffering tremendously from anxiety, I think from lockdown and COVID and all kinds of different things. But I was in not a good place, to say the least. And my husband said, I tell you what, we're going to go and have a nice week in Dubai. So off we went. And I was sitting by the pool one day and I could feel, I still felt very, very anxious, but I felt like life was saying, okay, the adventure's here. And all these strange kind of crazy thoughts were running through my head. And I said to my husband, what happens if we went and lived in Dubai for a bit and came here to look? I believed that, and I still believe, and actually no, I know now, there is a banquet of opportunity here. And if ever I'm going to find adventure, it's probably going to be here. And so my son was in uni. Our business is in safe hands here. Let's go. Let's go find adventure. And let's see what we can do. And let's run Joe Loves from that part of the world. And so as I looked up, I saw all these people jumping out of a plane. Something I would never, ever do in a million years. And I looked at him and I said, what do you think? And he said, I think it's a great idea. And I said, let's sign the deal and let's jump out of that plane tomorrow. And he's like 007. He loves an adventure, Gary. And yeah. Okay. And that's exactly what we did. We took ourselves off to skydiving course. Off we went. We were strapped up, got into a little plane. I was strapped to a huge Egyptian rugby player called Tarek. So nothing was going to happen on his ship, that was for sure. And up we go in the plane. And all I can tell you is I was so frightened. I was gripped with like this white fear. He opened the doors. We were the first one out of the plane. And my legs were dangling. And I went, I've changed my mind. And he said, too late, honey. We jump. And he pushed me and off we went. And I swear to this day, my anxiety was left in the plane and I've never felt it since. And that was a year ago. I have not had anxiety since the minute I jumped out of that plane. And it was as almost as though I confronted something within myself. I confronted the fear of just fear. And I realized that fear had gripped me and held me for so long and prevented me from doing so many things. I didn't want it to hold me any longer. And we came down, we went over the palm and we landed. And I would do it again tomorrow. In fact, when we go back in October, we're going to zip wire from the tall building. So I've suddenly got this taste of adventure. And it's very unlike me, but it's transformed something in me. I've found the 30-year-old woman again who wants to build and create. And that banquet of opportunity that I was talking about in Dubai has manifested itself so powerfully in our lives that I now know it was the right decision.
You've got to swim. You've got to learn to swim, Jo. You have to. If you can jump out of a plane, if you can jump out of a plane, you can swim in a pool. You are one of the most inspiring ladies. And I have absolutely loved talking to you. I can't thank you enough because it was just, I never thought that I'd actually be able to get to you. I have the utmost respect for you. And please send me that 11th bottle of the unnamed perfume and I'll send you my details. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you've enjoyed this series of events that made me, make sure you've given the podcast 5-star rating wherever you're listening. And follow me on Instagram at Liz Taylor Consultancy. Check out my website, liz-taylor-consulting.co.uk. And read the book, Taylor Made, available on Amazon.